If you are able to stand, I'm just picking on Zach today. Is that okay, Scott? It is, okay. I would like to read our passage, and the reason I want to do that is because we're going to go through it pretty quickly. It's a longer chunk, so let's read it all together, and then as we break into it, I'll tell you the section, I'll refer to it. I may highlight some words, but I want to actually read it all together. So, starting in verse 66 of chapter 22, we'll read until the end of verse 25. Starting in verse 66, it says, "When it was day, the council of elders of the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led Jesus away to their council chamber, saying, 'If you are the Christ, tell us.' But he said to them, 'If I tell you, you will not believe, and if I ask a question, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God.' And they said, 'Are you the Son of God then?' And he said to them, 'Yes, I am.' Then they said, 'What further need do we have of testimony? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth.' Then the whole body of them got up and brought him before Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king.' So Pilate asked him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' And he answered and said, 'It is as you say.' Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, 'I find no guilt in this man.' But they kept on insisting, saying, 'He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place.' When Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean, and when he heard that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was in Jerusalem at the time. Now Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he'd wanted to see him for a long time, because he had been hearing about him, and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. And he questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing, and the chief priests and the scribes were standing there, accusing him vehemently. And Herod with the soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. Now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day, for before they had been enemies with each other. Pilate summoned the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, 'You brought this man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion, and behold, having examined him before you, I found no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him. No, nor has Herod, for he sent him back to us, and behold, nothing deserving death has been done by him. Therefore, I will punish him and release him.' Now he is obliged to release to them at the feast one prisoner. But they cried out all together, saying, 'Away with this man, release for us Barabbas.' He was one who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection made in the city and for murder. Pilate, wanting to release Jesus, addressed them again. But they kept on calling out, saying, 'Crucify, crucify him.' And he said to them the third time, 'Why, what evil has this man done? I found in him no guilt, demanding death. Therefore, I will punish him and release him.' But they were insistent with loud voices, asking that he be crucified. And their voices began to prevail, and Pilate pronounced sentence that their demand be granted. And he released the man they were asking for, who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, but he delivered Jesus to their will." You may be seated. So as I said, there's a decent chunk, and I'll kind of refer to each section. As I thought about righteousness and unrighteousness, what this really trial does is just reveal the unrighteousness of man. It's really what this is about. But I think sometimes we look at this and I don't know if we would do this, but maybe subconsciously we may think, well, nowadays we get a much more righteous trial over this, and I have to remind ourselves three tenets that I'm going to bring up about this unrighteousness are present in our society today, actually because they're present in man today. So with that in mind, we're going to break this up into three sections, really. But with each of these things, it's not just how this took place. Certainly, there's a historical context of what this, you know, these things happen, right? But it's the nature of what you see revealed and how these things happen that we learn from, I believe. And the first one is that human righteousness is compromised with preconceived ideas. So the first section, which we go back to and read, was in 66 through 68. Where Jesus was officially tried. Now, what's bizarre is I want you to look at another passage in Matthew, yes, even though we read this passage, and I want you to notice something. Starting in verse 59, if you'll look at Matthew 26, this is going to be confusing, and the reason I bring this up is because you need to figure out what's going on with Luke, what he's recording, and then what's going on here in Matthew, because you may come to the conclusion Luke kind of botched the order of things, and I do not believe that's what's going on, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But here's how it reads starting in verse 59 of Matthew 26. It says, "Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. They did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward, but later on two came forward. And he said, 'This man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.' The high priest stood up and said to him, 'Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?' But Jesus kept silent. The high priest said to him, 'I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God.' And Jesus said to him, 'You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds.' Then the high priest tore his robes, and he said, 'He is blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy.' 'What do you think?' They answered, 'He deserves death.'" So, what do you read next? Just look. If you notice, I'm really trying to get people to read their Bibles. I think everyone needs to. But what follows in verse 69, you see is Peter's denials. And you're like, now wait a second. I mean, unless you were in Mexico, was it Mexico? Unless you're in Mexico, we knew Peter denied from last week, right? What's going on here? What happened to the order? Well, because that's really the thrust of the question. What's going on here? Because in Matthew 26, it sure seems like they already had a trial of the Sanhedrin. And this is where things get sticky if we don't know the procedures for having a trial. There's a component of how it's supposed to go, an official trial. And, you know, one of the things that's big is, we'll get into that. But what is going on here, there's two choices. Either Luke is sharing the events of the trial after they happened, and so he focuses on Peter's denial, or something else is occurring where it seems like there's two trials again. But they're different. They're similar but different. Well, the thing you need to know is that basically when Jesus was supposedly having that first trial we read about in Matthew, and Peter was making his denials, do you remember the first denial, what was going on? He was sitting somewhere when he was identified by a slave girl. And does it tell us why she was looking? You remember, she was looking intently at his face, trying to identify him. Because remember, she was a slave of the high priest. So she would have been in there when Jesus was teaching a whole bunch and to see the 12 that were around him. And she was looking through the fire. Because the light, that's what she was looking through the fire, at the light to be able to identify his face. Why do you have a fire going on? I mean, you're cold, but also it provides light. So it is dark outside as they first congregate in kind of in the middle of that courtyard around the fire. Now, why is that important? Because what I'm going to tell you is the Sanhedrin, also known as the Council of Elders, was Israel's Supreme Court, but it could only conduct cases involving potential capital punishment during daylight hours. So what we have here, I believe, is very clear, is this is the rubber stamp trial. In other words, they bring Jesus in, and as they bring him in, they're kind of doing a fact-finding, informal inquiry into Jesus and seeing what will stick. And then they have the trial when it becomes daylight so that they are doing things by the book. And so what Luke does is he does not tell us about that earlier fact-finding mission. He's focusing on the trial itself. So really what's going on, and I'll tell you, and you'll see this too, is what's really going on here is it's At this point in time, when they ask him, if they're asking him a second time, think about this. So if what we read in Matthew occurred already, and then we go to Luke, why are they asking him the question? Well, it's not about information anymore. It's about incrimination. Now we're having the trial, okay? That other stuff was kind of informal. Now we'll have the trial. Now we know what to ask him. And so that's why they go right to the question, really, if Jesus is the Messiah. And they know, based on how he already answered, he had already said that, right? But the other thing is, too, look very closely, if you can remember still from having read Matthew just a few minutes back. The way he answers, he doesn't mention about coming in the clouds. He just says in verse 69 that what's highlighted by Luke is the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power of God. So he's talking about, I would be at the position claiming to be the position of authority, making him the Messiah. And that's the thing, I guess, we can say is that as Jesus in verse 69 and 70 affirms his identity, he repeats somewhat what was said, but it's different. So I've got the Matthew verse up there to compare it to the Luke, and that's where you see the difference. Now you could say, oh, well, see, this is proof that that Matthew's got it right and Luke's putting this later. But there's something that's also interesting that Luke highlights. The response by tearing the clothes, the robe, is not there. Because he's already said that. So this has already happened. This is what I call a rubber stamp trial. It's a facade. We're just going through now the legal process to make it legal. So we can say we did it. Because again, what did I say? It's in their very own statutes about we cannot do a potential capital punishment case in the dark. It's got to be during daylight hours. But they're not stupid, so they're figuring out what will stick as they're doing. And they would say, oh, this is not a trial. We're just questioning to find out who you are. So this is really what's going on. So even just the nature of asking that question was really for an official statement. Because he doesn't ask for clarification. So why now? Because now think about this. Go back and consider in that Matthew passage the way that went down, because this is another fascinating thing. So in the Matthew passage, as he's talking to him and the priest gets upset, Matthew 26, what did I tell you? It was 63. He gives the quote in verse 64. And in the verse 65, there is no further clarification asking, now what do you mean, Jesus? The high priest tore his robes at him, quoting from Daniel. Now go to Luke. Now look at our Luke passage. That response is different. When he says in verse 69, but from now on the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God. No tearing of the robe, no getting mad. They asked for clarification, and they all said, are you the Son of God then? So what you have is, what can we get on record? It's kind of like if I take Kelly down to the police station. I'm a police officer, and I think I know he's guilty of stuff, and if he said some other incriminating things, I want to make it get on record. So we've got it officially on record. For people to say, see, this was a fair trial. This is what they're doing, is essence, asking him clarification. Are you the Son of God yet then? And he said to them, yes, I am. That's all they needed. They got the charge. Now you say, what's the point about mention about the Son of God? Well, here's the thing is Daryl Bach points this out in his commentary. He says, you know, the claim here is extensive. It was not a crime in ancient Judaism to claim to be Messiah, as the Bar Kochba revolt in AD 132 show. But Jesus is saying more than this. He's claiming to be able to go directly into God's presence and rule at the divinity side from heaven. So that's a problem, obviously, with the Jewish people. And you may say, well, look at the response. Is he admitting to it? So what do you have in, what do you have translated in your Bible there? Well, it depends. Some translations may say, you say that I am. Others, it is as you say. Or in this case, yes, I am. But basically the idea is, equivalent to saying, just how you said it, that's true. I am the Son of God. So he admits to it. They've got what they need. They don't need to build up anything else. They've got what they want for Jesus' first trial. Now here's the thing is, now how do I get the idea of preconceived ideas affect belief? Well, to see the idea that God would come in the flesh and come in such a manner that Jesus came with his mission does not fit the belief system of the religious leaders. The reason they're doing this is because the Messiah is not going to come. He's certainly not going to be Son of God. He's not going to be God in the flesh. He's not going to be that kind of Messiah. And by the way, here's the thing you got to ask. If I'm telling you a chief priest is a political position and the Sanhedrin is a ruling council, but they're also rulers, quote, religious leaders in the religion, and a Messiah comes, let's say he's not even a divine Messiah, let's say a Messiah comes. Would they really want a Messiah to come and upset their positions of leadership? Do you really think they would, knowing what we have seen from them? I don't think so. I think they would have an extremely hard position. Like, no, we like the position we're in. We don't like Rome. We just really want, what they wanted was, their belief was a Messiah that would come and basically be a general in an army. In essence, this would be, couldn't fit the definition of Messiah that you would read that falls under the category of a son of David in that line of being a king. Because I do not believe any of those religious leaders that have gathered to put this trial on really believe that the Messiah would come and be the kind of king that would say, I'm sorry, you're out of power, I'm the one in power. And it's why? Because I think that doesn't fit their belief system. They have created a belief system where everyone goes to them. So when I think about righteousness and the problem with man, preconceived ideas are part of the issue with the unrighteousness of man. You can call it a number. Preconceived, what does that mean? I was trying to think of synonyms. There's a lot. But preconceived is you come to a conclusion about something before you've really weighed out the evidence. You come to a conclusion about an idea, even before you've really weighed evidence. Now, to some extent, that happens. If you've never had rhubarb, the only thing you've heard about rhubarb maybe was negative. You may come to the conclusion you don't like rhubarb, but you've never really weighed out. I'm trying to think, the last person who found out I like rhubarb, maybe something rhubarb. Who made me rhubarb one time? It was really good because they found out I like rhubarb. I can't remember now. Isn't that terrible? I think it was, what's that? Oh, was it? Oh, Elizabeth Harris. She's not here. Well, that's right. She did find out. I would say, well, you got to examine the evidence and have Elizabeth Harris's rhubarb bars. And then tell me, you know, weigh out the evidence. So you haven't done that. But we have a tendency to do that, right? It's not necessarily wrong. Just we come to some conclusions before we weigh. But the problem is a preconceived idea that is not willing to be changed when you're presented with the evidence, that's the issue. And that's the problem with unrighteousness. Unrighteousness, and you know why we don't want to change that opinion? Because of sin, because it's very self-centered. It's the reason when we're confronted with our own sin, we don't want to sometimes repent, because the nature of sin is very self-centered. If I have to own up to, I was wrong, I did something wrong, that's not easy. It's not something, that means my ego is going to take a hit. I'm wrong. I've got to change something. That's the problem with sin. Preconceived ideas mean I don't really want to change. I'm good with my beliefs. And here's the thing is, this is the issue of sin is, we can't have perfect righteousness because sin has corrupted the way we think about things, the way we believe things. It has caused our minds, our beliefs, our attitudes to be faulty and self-serving. It's the reason there will be no trial, no court system, no jury that's going to be perfectly righteous. Now, we're lucky if we can get pretty objective and at least willing to get, and I think sometimes, we obviously the court systems do get things right, but they're made up of sinful human beings. But here's the real issue is, as it comes to our salvation, sin is wanting to cause us to reject truth because it doesn't fit our system of how we believe already. How do you break through to that? Because all preconceived ideas do is lead to hardness of heart. How can we change that? I can't change your mind. I really can't. If you're not open to having your mind changed, how can I go share the gospel with somebody who does not believe in Jesus right now, that Jesus is the only way? How could I possibly do that and cause anything to change in their mind? I'll give you a hint. It's called prayer. Go through the Gospels and the epistles. Go through the New Testament. See how many times prayer is also associated with evangelism. I dare you. It's in there more often than you realize. This is a spiritual endeavor. What we're asking is to deal with unrighteousness is God's got to intervene. And that's ultimately what we're really after. The second thing we notice in this trial, this next section is, human righteousness is compromised with convenience. Well, it starts with Pilate, right? So we're introduced to Pontius Pilate, verses 1 through 4. The Sanhedrin leads Jesus over there. Why? Well, while subject territories of Rome were given a measure of self-government, it appears that the right of sword, that is capital offense, that's going to happen. It's reserved for the Roman government. Now, just think about this. Why would that be? So if I'm asking Brian Terry, why do you think they don't want these little puppet governments to be able to try their own citizens and kill them? They want to be the ones to charge that. Why do you think? And I think the answer may not be so obvious, but here's the thing. You can control people with a threat of sword. So you can actually manipulate your own citizens so that you have a stronger force to rebel against Rome if you have that kind of power. So I think one of the reasons for Rome doing what it does is to say, no, we're going to be the ones who execute people. Why? Because all Rome is really cared about is, we're not going to self-govern some of these things, but we want to be in charge of the big things. And number one, a huge thing is, we want all your resources. We want your money. We want your agriculture, all that. Tax, 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 tax. And we know that you can manipulate people through threatening them by the sword, ultimately. We don't want you to have that kind of power. So that's why Pontius Pilate needs to be involved. Well, who's Pontius Pilate? Who's this guy? He's the Roman governor of Judea, appointed to keep peace and directly collect the taxes, as well as uphold Roman culture. Now, which one do you think is the most important of the three? money. I say money, it's not just money, but it's those taxes, right? And you're not going to collect the taxes if there's not peace. Those two are related. According to Philo, if we want to know a little bit about this character, Pilate, right? He's known to have treated Jewish customs with contempt. However, by the way, you may think, well, he's going to walk all over them. No, if there starts to be a problem, he's going to cave in. And I think that's important to understand because he says, the first provocation occurred around 26 AD. He introduced embossed figures of the emperor. But he ended up taking them away. Now, why would that be a problem for Israel? Because it's making an image. It's kind of a direct violation of a commandment. Which number? Bonus points. Anyone? Hey, what'd you say, Harold? Second? Yeah. Violating second command. So, it basically, according to Philo, he said, Pilate ended up taking them away when a number of Jews voluntarily laid down before soldiers when they drew their swords to quell the uprising. He realized this is going to get worse. So he caved in because he knew if they have not. By the way, if Pilate does not do his job, guess what happens to Pilate? He does not have a balloon. What do they call it? The golden parachute. He's not going to the Bahamas and living his life out. He's dead. Caesar isn't going to fool around with him. Off with his head. Not fooling with that. So, the ringing of the pilot, the first four verses. Now, here's what's interesting. You'll notice they're charging Jesus with opposing Rome. We found this man misleading our nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ the King. So there are three. He's misleading Israel. He forbid the paying of taxes to Caesar. He claimed to be a king. Those are the three accusations. What's interesting is if you read, what is highlighted by Luke is honing in on? The third one, right? Well, the final charge, or the first charge is not important. But the second one is important because the collection of taxes, as we said, is a key component. You stop that money line, pipeline flowing to Rome, there's a problem. Got to keep that going. And so, but if you look at the third charge, it would speak to the second charge because if this guy has authority over all the other people to do that. Now, if this claim about being a king, nobody really cares or he's not affected, then we're not really worried about it, right? Because he can't influence people. I mean, that's the point. If he has no authority, he can't really influence people to not pay taxes. So that's why he gets to the third claim or addresses it. And it's interesting because it says his answer. So if you look at it from Luke, and Luke doesn't tell us all the details, right? If you look at it, are you the Son of God then? And he said to them, yes, I am. Then he said, what further need do we have? Do you feel like there's something missing? He was fine with that. Oh, well, there's no charges. Well, what might we be missing? So in an attempt to put the verses up there for you just to save a bit of time, however, if you can't read as well or you need new glasses, then you can find this in John 18, right? But John 18, 33 through 36 fills us in on that unabridged conversation and how Pilate asked Jesus the question. He says, Therefore, Pilate entered into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered, are you saying this on your own initiative or did others tell you about me? Pilate answered, I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation, the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done? Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. Therefore, Pilate said to him, so you are a king? Jesus answered, you say correctly that I am a king. That's the part that's not included in Luke. But obviously, from what John tells us, is he's not claiming ownership of the kingdom here and now. Now, why is that important? Because he's not telling anyone not to pay taxes. So what Luke does is just summarize it. Says, it is as I am. And then Pilate's response. I'm not alarmed. I'm not worried about it. I don't see any charges for it. He's not exercising influence. He's not guilty. For somebody who is this interested, because that's really what it is, it's like, why would just put someone to death for that when there's nothing valid here? But the people that got him and they paid one of his disciples money to get him and arrest him are not going to be happy. So they continue to insist on Jesus being guilty in verses 5 through 8. Because why? We got to this trouble. We want him dead. So they keep hammering him. But as they continue to accuse Jesus, what Pilate discovers is he hears something in there, right? Like, oh, this is kind of convenient for me. He's like, oh, he's from Galilee. Well, really? That's not my jurisdiction. Whose jurisdiction is it? Herod Antipas. You guys remember that guy? I was going to say a very corny joke about heads will roll. He did behead John the Baptist, if you didn't know. But he was fascinated to talk with John the Baptist, but not from the standpoint of being convicted. He was just entertained is really the idea. So this is that guy. And by the way, then we're not really so surprised because he's also fascinated with who? With Jesus, as we're going to see. Now, the other thing we need to understand is, so this allows Pilate to say, oh, well, go talk to him. But it's very handy is, he's in Jerusalem because it's the festival. Very convenient, right? We'll just send him right over. He's staying somewhere else. So this is really about convenience for Pilate. It's not about truth. And Herod Antipas is greatly pleased. In fact, what we're told, if you recall, Luke 9:9, how we're introduced the fact that John the Baptist was beheaded. It said, Herod said, I myself had John beheaded, but who's this man about whom I hear such things? Talking about Jesus. And he kept trying to see him. So he had this desire to see Jesus, and we'll see in a minute why. But he's heard all these stories about this Jesus, and especially where did Jesus perform a number of his miracles? It's around Galilee, especially the Jewish parts. Although we know in Gentile parts he did perform miracles as well. And you know what? If you're Pilate, wow, this is pretty convenient for me. They're so insistent. I can just hand it off to this guy. He'll take care of the problem. I'm out of it. And what do we find in verses 9 through 12? Nothing happens with Herod either, right? Well, Jesus asked questions and accused of things. Other Gospels would tell us probably a little bit more detail with some things, but essentially, Jesus does not answer anything. And the chief priests and scribes that were with him were standing there saying the same thing they've been saying to Pilate. But basically, after Herod doesn't get a response, then Herod and soldiers were making a mockery of Jesus for their entertainment purposes. Because the reason they wanted to see Jesus is they were looking for entertainment. I mean, it says it right there, basically in verse 8, they were hoping to see some signs performed by Jesus. That's all he really wanted. It's funny, they didn't really want to really truth. Well, obviously we know that from Herod Antipas. He's notoriously staying away from truth. He marries his brother's wife. They have the affair, divorce each other's spouses, and then get together. And then John the Baptist tells them how unrighteous that is.
And then Herod Antipas' wife tricks the daughter into doing, get him into a situation where he's got to follow through and behead John the Baptist. But John the Baptist was entertainment for him. So that's all he's really after is entertainment. It's not about truth. But yet he can't find anything. So they kind of mock him for their entertainment purposes, but they don't really care about truth. That's it. And then they just send him back to Pilate. Like, okay, well, I thought maybe this would be more entertaining, but at least I got to see who this guy was that I've heard all about, got to talk with him. And there's no judicial ruling that we read about. But on the other end, we will be told basically the equivalent of being sent back to Pilate is a ruling, right? But it and by the way, it was convenient for Pilate because even though Jesus came back, it says it caused their friendship to happen when they previously had been enemies. So there was convenience for him as well. Again, if we're simply about what's the right thing. Do you ever remember telling your kids at one point in time they're faced with a decision and you say, yeah, but what's really the right thing to do here? Not the easiest thing, but right thing. Anybody ever tell your kids that? I know it's not the easy thing, but what is the right thing, right, Amal? Sometimes the right thing may not be the easiest thing. That's not Pilate. Pilate wanted some benefit. He did not want to do the right thing, and that's why he passed it. And even when he gets back, he's not about truth, as we'll see. Because here's the thing. Pilate, at any point in time, had the authority to put a stop to unrighteous accusations against Jesus. But he looked for an easier way out by passing Jesus on to Herod. And you know what? The sinfulness of humanity looks to do what's convenient and easy rather than what's right. That's the problem of sin. And you know, for the unbeliever, it seems easier to ignore your sinful condition, even though in reality God will punish that sin, but it's more convenient to find ways I'm going to avoid it. I'm not going to think about it. I mean, we know logically that's not right. In fact, we know logically, like if you have symptoms that you're really sick and you've got something going on, and maybe it's cancer or something else, but I don't want to hear those words, so I just won't go to the doctor. It might be convenient to not do that in one sense, but it's not right. It doesn't make the truth go away. As it comes to this, as it relates to your spiritual condition, you are sick. It's called sin. It may be convenient to find ways to ignore it, delve into other pleasures, mock Christianity, mock any kind of a God that will hold people to a standard, but it doesn't mean it's truth. And the reality is, God will, in reality, punish sin. So, that's the thing we have to deal with. Now, for what about the believer? It's convenient to keep the truth of the gospel to ourselves. Ah, now we're stepping on toes, right? It's not easy sometimes to share with people something they don't like to hear. But let me ask you, that person that you, it's more convenient not to talk to them, are they going to be judged any less for their sin? That person that maybe you may be the only person who is saved by Jesus Christ that's in their life, is it more convenient? I mean, not more convenient. Does it mean that they're going to be judged any less for sin because you know them? Or is God a righteous God that will judge all sin equitably and fair? And if that is the case, is your convenience a good thing? Is it convenient in reality of the truth that God judges all sin to say nothing? I know it's stepping on toes. I mean, for all of us, right? That's the problem of unrighteousness. Even as believers, we deal with this thing called the flesh. You know, the tendency still that's there to sin. And I think one of the ways is to not proclaim the truth because it's not convenient. Because now they may not like me because I told them, you know, I'm sorry, you're a sinner and you have to be saved. And people may not like me. They may not want to talk to me anymore. Oh, well, they'll talk to me now. I just won't say anything. And then eternity comes. And I'm not saying, by the way, they're going to respond to you. We don't know that. That's not our job. Our job is just to tell them the truth. Which I would say when you share the gospel, you're just telling them the truth. You know, hey, if I didn't care about you, I wouldn't even tell you this. You know, you can do with it what you want, but I've got to at least tell you that there's someone who died for your sins, that you don't have to worry about what happens when I die, because guess what? If you looked around, everyone's dying. I've never seen anyone be immortal. Do you know anyone who's 200 years old? 300 years? Nope. They kind of stop at weddings at that, right? They don't get past. Who's the oldest person? Or I guess it's the longest married. They don't do that because everyone dies. So why would that be any different? Well, why wouldn't you tell them the truth? Because if you really believe it, if this is true for you, if it's really true for you, convenience is not a good thing to not share the gospel. It really isn't. And I think that's a challenge because when we don't do that, we're not being righteous with the truth we have. We were not saved to, and left on this earth to not open our mouth at all. God didn't say, I'm going to save you. I'm going to pick on Doug just because he's in the back. And I'm not saying he doesn't share the gospel. But he doesn't tell Doug, well, I'm going to save you, Doug. But you know what? Just don't say anything about me. Just live your own life. Don't say a single thing. Does that sound like God? What's the word ambassador mean? You're representing something. And by the way, as I've noticed since I'm not a Chiefs fan, just so you know, all non-Chiefs fans unite. But I can't believe how many Chiefs stuff I've seen around so much lately, right? People aren't afraid to share their Chiefs gear and their hats and their t-shirts, right? They're not worried about offending someone else. But why is it when it comes to Jesus, we're afraid we're going to offend somebody? I mean, you can be offensive, but you can be offensive with a number of things. That's probably because you're just being offensive. But this is the thing is I'm sitting here looking at this trial, how unrighteous it is, and it's really revealing the unrighteousness of man. But as believers, we've been declared righteous because of what Jesus did for us. Okay, but one of those things is then what he's done for us, we're supposed to share. It's not about convenience. You got saved to be an ambassador. That's one of your primary purposes in life. When you go see Jesus at the end of your life, you'll have an account to give. Now, it has nothing to do with your salvation, but you'll have an account to give. What have you done with this truth that you can share about me doing this? We all will. And then it gets to our third and last part in this trial. Human righteousness is compromised by selfishness, because this kind of ties in with convenience, right? So we have Pilate's ruling, which you notice in verses 13 through 16. He doesn't want to rule death, does he? So he gathers the group together. He makes this ruling. And what is it? And here's the crazy thing. It's not even a righteous ruling, is it? Because what does it say he's going to do? Well, first of all, let's talk about what he said. You brought this man to me as one who incites people to rebellion. Behold, having examined him before you, I've found no guilt. So there's no guilt. But in verse 16, he's still going to punish him. But release him, but give him some kind of punishment, which is not right, actually. But basically, he can't find anything. If he's being honest, there's no support for that charge. In fact, he even tells us, really, by what Herod did, Herod declared there was no guilt in him. So that's two men who are in positions of power to make a ruling who have said Jesus is not guilty. And by the way, Pilate is trying to get himself off the hook. So he issues his verdict, but he says there's punishment. And we know why he's doing that. It's like, oh, well, at least I'll beat him pretty good for you. Now, there's an argument, maybe. There's a type of punishment you would have that if you're going to the cross, that would be different as it relates to a whipping. And that is, and I'm sure you guys are familiar, I'm not going to get all into that now, but it's the type of, when you beat a man who's going to be crucified, you beat him in such a way that there's enough blood loss that when he is on the cross, because technically, if you didn't do this, the man, I'm just saying man, because typically that's who it is that's being crucified, the Roman crucifixion, could be on that cross for several days. The reason you beat him in the manner that you do with the blood loss is so he cannot survive as long. It's, you know what, it's just as painful to watch it and conduct it. And I think that's part of the point. It's like, we don't want to make this a long, drawn-out thing. That's the point of beating him. And by the way, that's what Jesus had. But I don't know if he was up for that kind of a beating when Pilate said he was going to, you know, scourge him. But he ends up changing his verdict. Now, I think the beating would have been a beating that none of us wanted, right? Even if you're not using the typical scourge, which tears at flesh, if you, even just a whip would be not enjoyable, right? But what we see here, and it's kind of convoluted, this last section, 17 through 25. But verse 17 actually is probably not found in the earliest manuscripts. It doesn't mean what was said there is any less true, but I don't think it was original. I think it was some of the earliest manuscripts didn't have it, but it's one of those calls that's like, well, is it original or not? They put it in there, and they put it in with brackets. Some of you may have in your Bibles. I don't know. It says early manuscripts do not contain this verse. But yes, it's true. This is the event. See, there was a yearly event around the Passover festival that was supposed to develop relationships between, or good relations between, the Roman ruler and his subjects. And it was an acquittal of a prisoner not yet condemned or the pardoning of one who was already condemned. So this is what's going on. Now, ironically, Jesus was the one that was falsely accused of insurrection. The man we're talking about, Barabbas, he was guilty of insurrection and murder, something Jesus didn't do. But what we're told is the crowd is riled up by the chief priests to ask for the release of Barabbas in the place of Jesus. And by the way, this crowd that was riled up was most likely part of this crowd that they had drummed up. So if you will, you have your Sanhedrin, your smaller group, but then there was probably an extension of those people. So this was not, I think, sometimes portrayed. I think the Passion of the Christ might have said this. Not said it, but portrayed it this way. It's like it was just a general crowd. I do think this was like a pro-religious leader, pro-Sanhedrin crowd that was accompanying them. Because remember, Jesus, you couldn't fit all those people in the palace originally. So when Jesus was being questioned informally, right? Peter's in the courtyard, and there's groups of people in the courtyard. So there's another layer of group of people. I think this is some of the people that were out in that crowd. And I think this is kind of how this whole thing went down. Because I still think, here's the thing, is you got to go back to, if everybody was so against Jesus, then they could have just jumped right in the middle of daytime in the temple while he's teaching and arresting him. That's the whole point of this. So it didn't just change in 24 hours. This is a group that is stacked against Jesus. And they want him to be crucified. So what they're saying is basically to have Jesus be in the place of Barabbas, give us Barabbas instead of releasing Jesus. And the riling up, and Pilate attempts to get the crowd to consider what they're asking, right? And, you know, if you look in the account, it's like one right after the other. They're like, I find no guilt in this man. What evil has this man done? Hey, I'm just going to punish him and release him. So the fact that Pilate does this a couple different times tells you he does not want to do this. So what happens? He knows there's enough of unrest that they can cause trouble. So the mob's demands are met. The crowd that was being so insistent that Jesus is crucified, evidently there was enough there, it was scary enough for Pilate to give in to their demand for Jesus' crucifixion. So here you have Barabbas. The funny thing is, Barabbas is the one who is guilty. Clearly guilty. But he is released for the sake of Jesus being put to death. And then you have Pilate, is the character in here, who is a man who knew that truth was staring him in the face when he spoke with Jesus, but the overarching fear of trouble and wanting to gain favor with the people overruled truth. John has a section about this discussion about truth with Pilate, if you remember. What is truth? And really, without preaching that sermon, I'm not doing that. It's just fascinating to see the way that unfolds. And basically, Jesus is defining truth for him. And Pilate, because truth is what is really convenient for him, is not getting it. Ultimately, what we see is a sad state of disregard for what is righteous by the one who could actually see the truth. He was looking at him. The problem, though, is not seeing the truth. Pilate was there. The problem is believing in the truth. See, if Pilate really believed that Jesus was who he said he was, if he really believed, would he have allowed this to happen? Well, under the will of God, it would have happened. But maybe not under Pontius Pilate. So the crazy thing is that this had to happen for us. You get how strange this whole thing is, in essence. He had to be treated so wrongly. This whole fiasco of a trial had to be so unrighteous so that we could be saved. Which, by the way, I start thinking about this, and I'm thinking, so anybody who says, well, I've been done so wrong and so dirty, and people treated me so bad that, like, I'm the worst person in the world to get it. Come read this passage, will you? No, you haven't been at this state. I'm sorry. There's a reason for this. So when I think about this, it's really about selfishness for Pilate. He just does it because he knows I'm not putting my head on the chopping block by holding on to the truth. And see, the problem with unbelievers is you can see what is true and righteous, but because of selfishness, which is the very definition of sin, you won't embrace the truth. And by the way, selfishness is a problem for all of us, right? Not just an unbeliever, for a believer. Now, for unbelievers, it's at the core of why we sin, because we're selfish. But for believers, and what we have, what the residual leftover sin that we still deal with called the flesh, it's the reason our selfishness, why we don't share the gospel. It's also the reason why we don't set aside the good for the best in terms of our spiritual choices. A lot of us are believers, but we settle because we're selfish. Now, I don't know what that means in each one of us. I just know what it means for me, and I know what I know how it's easy, because our selfishness is the reason we aren't doing as well spiritually as we could be. But the crazy thing is, so if I finish here, this is like, man, this is just a bummer. Yeah, finishing with the bummer of a story. Actually, the crazy thing is, on a positive note, is the dark, in this dark story is that there's true victory. Because here's the crazy thing. Did you figure this out? That Jesus took the place of Barabbas, the righteous for the guilty. Now, that's not the gospel, but it is showing you what was going to be the gospel when Jesus goes to the cross. Barabbas is the guilty. He has nothing to say. He is released. Jesus is the reason he is released. Because Barabbas, in all rights, probably was the one who was going to be on that cross, crucified. So he took his place. And that's the precursor to what the cross will bring for any sinner that desires to turn from a life that's cursed by sin to trusting in Jesus for what he accomplishes through his life, death, and resurrection. It's the gospel, right? So all that being said, that even in all of this, we see that righteousness will prevail in the midst of everything being unrighteous. So let's finish in prayer. And I'm also going to pray for the food. And then I guess, even if you didn't bring anything, please join us, because there's always plenty of food.